Mayweather hits.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower. And our stories are written especially for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, a news update from Jill Robbins on the situation in Afghanistan. Then, Alice Bryant brings us Ask a Teacher. This week on American Stories, we will hear part one of The Diamond Lens. Then, Gregory Stockel will bring us the arts and culture story. But first, Jill Robbins.
The Taliban urged local religious leaders to push a message of unity at Friday's prayers. But reports of targeted killings increased fears that the militants will return Afghanistan to their past repressive rule. Fearful that the new rulers would carry out such abuses, thousands of Afghans have raced to Kabul's airport and border crossings to flee the country. Others have protested around the country and were met with violence. The Taliban say they have become more moderate since they last ruled Afghanistan in the 1990s. They have promised to restore security and forgive those who fought them in the 20 years since a U.S.-led invasion. Ahead of Friday prayers, the militants asked religious leaders to call for unity and urge people not to flee the country. But many Afghans are doubtful, fearing that the Taliban will take away the progress, especially for women, made in the past 20 years. An Amnesty International report provided more evidence Friday that weakened the Taliban's claims. The rights group said its researchers spoke to eyewitnesses in Ghazni province. They said the Taliban killed 9 ethnic Hazara men in the village of Mundarakht on July 4th to the 6th. The report said 6 of the men were shot and 3 were tortured to death. Hazaras are Shiite Muslims who were previously persecuted by the Taliban. The group has made major gains in education and social standing in recent years. Agnes Calamard is the head of Amnesty International. She said the killings were a reminder of the Taliban's past record and showed what Taliban rule may bring. The rights group warned that many more killings may have gone unreported. The Taliban have cut phone services in many areas to prevent images from being published. Separately, Reporters Without Borders said media workers in Afghanistan are in extreme danger. The group issued the warning after Taliban fighters killed the family member of an Afghan reporter working for German broadcaster Deutsche Welle on Wednesday. Sadly, this confirms our worst fears, said Katja Glager of the Press Freedom Group. A Norway-based private intelligence group also said it has evidence that the Taliban have rounded up Afghans who worked with the previous Afghan administration or with U.S.-led forces. Mohammed Naim was among the crowd at Kabul's airport for 4 days trying to escape. He said he had to put his children on top of a car on the first day to save them from being crushed by the mass of people. He saw other children killed who were unable to get out of the way. Naim said he had been an interpreter for U.S. forces. he urged others not to come to the airport. It is a very, very crazy situation right now, and I hope the situation gets better, because I saw kids dying. It is very terrible, he said. The United States is struggling to increase the number of flights it is running from Afghanistan, where thousands of Americans and their Afghan allies need to leave the country. European countries are also working to bring their citizens and Afghan allies out. But continued disorder at the airport has made it difficult to organize the flights. A Spanish official said Friday that its military transport planes are leaving Kabul partly empty. Getting to the airport is also a major problem. Germany was sending two helicopters to Kabul to help bring small numbers of people from elsewhere in the city to the airport, officials said. As concerns rise about what a Taliban government will look like, the group's leaders are meeting with some officials from previous Afghan administrations. An Afghan official familiar with those talks told the Associated Press there would be no results from them before the last U.S. troops leave, currently planned for August 31st. I'm Jill Robbins.
Next is a story from Alice Bryant.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from an English learner in South Korea who recently began using our website. The reader says, "Dear VOA, I want to know the difference between true and real. Would you tell me? Thank you very much." Hello, and thanks for asking this useful question. I am an English teacher, but when I study other languages, sometimes I also confuse these two adjectives. In English, true and real have clear differences. Let's start with true. True means something is factually correct. Knowing its opposite is helpful. The opposite of true is false or incorrect. Take this as an example. Did you know that flamingo birds feed their babies with a red liquid called crop milk? It's true. That means it is factual. Real means actually existing or happening. The opposite of real is fictional or imaginary. Take this sentence as an example. I just learned that narwhals are real animals. That means that they are not imaginary creatures. They actually exist. Real can also mean authentic. For example, if someone says, "This jewel is real," they are saying the stone is authentic. Now, let's talk about adverbs. When true and real take adverb form, some English learners may be unsure which to choose. The good news is that, as adverbs, both of these words often mean something like very. For example, if someone says, "I am truly sorry," it is like saying, "I am really sorry." If someone says, "It was really hot this morning," it's like saying, "It was truly hot this morning." Note that "really" is more common than "truly" in spoken English. And that's Ask a Teacher for this week. I'm Alice Bryant.
Our story today is called The Diamond Lens. It was written by FitzJames O'Brien. We will tell the story in two parts. Now, here is Morris Joyce with part one of The Diamond Lens.
When I was 10 years old, one of my older cousins gave me a microscope. The first time I looked through its magic lens, the clouds that surrounded my daily life rolled away. I saw a universe of tiny living creatures in a drop of water. Day after day, night after night, I studied life under my microscope. The fungus that spoiled my mother's jam was, for me, a land of magic gardens. I would put one of those spots of green mold under my microscope and see beautiful forests where strange silver and golden fruit hung from the branches of tiny trees. I felt as if I had discovered another Garden of Eden. Although I didn't tell anyone about my secret world, I decided to spend my life studying the microscope. My parents had other plans for me. When I was nearly 20 years old, they insisted that I learn a profession. Even though we were a rich family, and I really didn't have to work at all, I decided to study medicine in New York. This city was far away from my family, so I could spend my time as I pleased. As long as I paid my medical school fees every year, my family would never know I wasn't attending any classes. In New York, I would be able to buy excellent microscopes and meet scientists from all over the world. I would have plenty of money and plenty of time to spend on my dream. I left home with high hopes. 2 days after I arrived in New York, I found a place to live. It was large enough for me to use one of the rooms as my laboratory. I filled this room with expensive scientific equipment that I did not know how to use. But by the end of my first year in the city, I had become an expert with the microscope. I also had become more and more unhappy. The lens in my expensive microscope was still not strong enough to answer my questions about life. I imagined there was still secrets in nature that the limited power of my equipment prevented me from knowing. I lay awake nights, wishing to find the perfect lens, an instrument of great magnifying power. Such a lens would permit me to see life in the smallest parts of its development. I was sure that a powerful lens like that could be built, and I spent my second year in New York trying to create it. I experimented with every kind of material. I tried simple glass, crystal, and even precious stones, but I always found myself back where I started. My parents were angry at the lack of progress in my medical studies. I had not gone to one class since arriving in New York. Also, I had spent a lot of money on my experiments. One day, while I was working in my laboratory, Jules Simon knocked at my door. He lived in the apartment just above mine. I knew he loved jewelry, expensive clothing, and good living. There was something mysterious about him, too. He always had something to sell. A painting, a rare statue, an expensive pair of lamps. I never understood why Simon did this. He didn't seem to need the money. He had many friends among the best families of New York. Simon was very excited as he came into my laboratory. "Oh, my dear fellow," he gasped, "I have just seen the most amazing thing in the world." He told me he had gone to visit a woman who had strange magical powers. She could speak to the dead and read the minds of the living. To test her, Simon had written some questions about himself on a piece of paper. The woman, Madame Vulpes, had answered all of the questions correctly. Hearing about this woman gave me an idea. Perhaps she would be able to help me discover the secret of the perfect lens. 2 days later, I went to her house. Madame Vulpes was an ugly woman with sharp, cruel eyes. She didn't say a word to me when she opened the door, but took me right into her living room. We sat down at a large, round table, and she spoke. "What do you want from me?" "I want to speak to a person who died many years before I was born." "Put your hands on the table." We sat there for several minutes. The room grew darker and darker, but Madame Vulpes did not turn on any lights. I began to feel a little silly. Then I felt a series of violent knocks. They shook the table, the back of my chair, the floor under my feet, and even the windows. Madame Vulpes smiled. "They are very strong tonight. You are lucky. They want you to write down the name of the spirit you wish to talk to." I tore a piece of paper out of my notebook and wrote down a name. I didn't show it to Madame Vulpes. After a moment, Madame Vulpes' hand began to shake so hard the table moved. She said a spirit was now holding her hand and would write me a message. I gave her paper and a pencil. She wrote something and gave the paper to me. The message read, "I am here. Question me." It was signed, Leeuwenhoek. I couldn't believe my eyes. The name was the same one I had written on my piece of paper. I was sure that an ignorant woman like Madame Vulpes would not know who Leeuwenhoek was. Why would she know the name of the man who invented the microscope? Quickly, I wrote a question on another piece of paper. How can I create the perfect lens? Leeuwenhoek wrote back, "Find a diamond of 140 carats. Give it a strong electrical charge. The electricity will change the diamond's atoms. From that stone, you can form the perfect lens." I left Madame Vulpes' house in a state of painful excitement. Where would I find a diamond that large? All my family's money could not buy a diamond like that, and even if I had enough money, I knew that such diamonds are very difficult to find. When I came home, I saw a light in Simon's window. I climbed the stairs to his apartment and went in without knocking. Simon's back was toward me as he bent over a lamp. He looked as if he were carefully studying a small object in his hands. As soon as he heard me enter, he put the object in his pocket. His face became red, and he seemed very nervous. "What are you looking at?" I asked. Simon didn't answer me. Instead, he laughed nervously and told me to sit down. I couldn't wait to tell him my news. "Simon, I have just come from Madame Volpe's. She gave me some important information that will help me find the perfect lens. If only I could find a diamond that weighs 140 carats. My words seemed to change Simon into a wild animal. He rushed to a small table and grabbed a long, thin knife. "No," he shouted. "You won't get my treasure. I'll die before I give it to you." "My dear Simon," I said, "I don't know what you are talking about. I went to Madame Volpe's to ask her for help with a scientific problem. She told me I needed an enormous diamond. You could not possibly own a diamond that large. If you did, you would be very rich, and you wouldn't be living here." He stared at me for a second, and then he laughed and apologized. "Simon," I suggested, "let us drink some wine and forget all this. I have two bottles downstairs in my apartment. What do you think?" "I like your idea," he said. I brought the wine to his apartment, and we began to drink. By the time we had finished the first bottle, Simon was very sleepy and very drunk. I felt as calm as ever, for I believed that I knew Simon's secret.
You have just heard part one of The Diamond Lens by FitzJames O'Brien. It was adapted for Special English by Donna DeSanctis. Your storyteller was Morris Joyce. Listen again next week for the final part of our story told in Special English on The Voice of America. This is Shirley Griffith.
Let's hear from Gregory Stockel.
Broadway, the collection of major theaters in the United States, has seen the longest shutdown in its history. It is set on proving that there's no business like show business. Hopes are high for reopening of musicals and plays starting in September. They are led by the three big musicals in the industry, Hamilton, The Lion King, and Wicked. These three musicals were taking in about $1 million a week before the 18-month shutdown began in March 2020. theaters will be permitted to fill their seats to 100%. Actors and other crew members will be required to show proof of vaccination. Always ready for risks, Broadway producers are backing new projects even with millions of dollars in lost sales. Ken Davenport is a producer who has won Tony Awards, the highest award on Broadway, for his musicals Kinky Boots and Once on This Island. He said, "Producers produce what they're passionate about. There's nothing safe about what we do. If we wanted safe, we would be in investment banking or an accountant or a lawyer." Davenport has 6 new shows in development. He said, "This is a business that favors the bold." He believes there will be a rebirth of theater over the next 5 years. Starting a new Broadway musical requires an immediate investment of about $10 to $15 million. This includes wages for the cast and crew, advertising, backgrounds, and makeup. Plays, without music, generally cost less than half that number. Broadway's hopes are still high, even though important producer Scott Rudin said in April he would take a leave from the business for a while after several accusations of bullying actors and others. Rudin has apologized for his behavior. Instead, Rudin's step back has opened the way for new investors who want big projects like bringing back musicals from the past, such as Funny Girl and Dreamgirls. Gordon Cox is a head writer on theater for Variety, which covers Broadway. He said Rudin's step back has not left a hole. He added there are whole groups of people that now feel they can get involved and it seems like a cool thing to do. Sadly, Disney musical Frozen is not returning. Rudin backed 2020 renewal of West Side Story is not returning. And the 2-part Harry Potter play is being combined into one. The Broadway League said it will not release official numbers of returns for the next few months. However, sales websites show formerly popular shows have had slow sales. 7 new plays have been announced for this fall, all by Black writers. Some are being financed by first-time Broadway investors. They include co-founder of the television network BET, Sheila Johnson, who is putting money behind the play Thoughts of a Colored Man. Actor Blair Underwood and former sportsperson Renee Montgomery are investing in the play Passover, a modern remake of Waiting for Godot. Brian Moreland is the producer of Thoughts of a Colored Man, opening in October. He said, "There is various new money that is coming into Broadway, and that money is extraordinarily helpful, and it is also diverse money, which is also very interesting and new." I'm Gregory Stockel.
And that is our program for today. Thanks for listening. Some content in this program was provided by the Associated Press or Reuters News Agency. Join us again tomorrow to learn English with stories from around the world. I'm Anna Mateo.